This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
Across Northern Ireland, on your radio and on BBC Sounds. This is
The Stephen Nolan Show!
What is happening within the Northern Ireland Civil Service with regards to the notes that they can't find or couldn't find, the equipment that they say is missing? Why is this so important? Well, it's not just important for the COVID inquiry, and that is at the height of importance. There's another issue. What type of sensitive information is on equipment that the Northern Ireland Civil Service have now lost? The interim head of the Civil Service, a lady called Jenny Piper, they can't find her equipment. They say they've lost it. So we're asking, are lives at risk? If they don't know where the equipment is, how do they know it's inside their building? Is it on the outside? Is it on the hands of people, in the hands of people who shouldn't have it? What type of information is on that equipment? Issues of national security, is that on it? Policing matters? Justice matters? Victims of sexual and domestic abuse? Like, what type of information feeds in to the top of our government system? And how do they lose this stuff? Like, what the heck is going on? Who's going to be accountable? All coming up on today's program.
The Stephen Nolan Show!
Good morning. A very important program this morning about the Northern Ireland Civil Service, about whether information is safe, about whether anybody has been put at risk, whether any life has been put at risk because they've lost now equipment, or we learn they've lost equipment for many, many months. Where is it? Is it still inside their building? Is it outside? Why do things mysteriously go missing within the civil service? How come grown adults are told not to wipe information and all of a sudden it's wiped? We have significant questions for the civil service this morning on behalf of us all, and we'll come round to that in just a moment or two. First though, a man in his 20s found nailed to a fence, a nail through each hand. Two vans, one belonging to the injured man, found on fire in a car park near a park. Graffiti on nearby public toilets linked to the assault, linked to the arson. The Belfast Telegraph crime correspondent Alison Morris with us this morning. Talk us through what happened here, Alison.
Yeah, so as you say, the emergency services were called initially to the alerted to the burning vans in the car park. There was a lot of people, it was a bank holiday weekend, there were a lot of people up that part of the coast who were camped out, and they're mainly the eyewitnesses to this assault. And then the man was discovered nailed to a nearby fence. He is, as you said, a man in his 20s who owned one of the vans that was on fire in the car park. He's rushed to hospital. We're told his injuries could be life-changing. And the barbarity of it, obviously, you know, the PSNR are saying that it has the hallmarks of what we would call a paramilitary-style attack, what in the past people probably would have called punishment attacks. And that's one of their lines of inquiry. It seems from people that I was speaking to yesterday that it's linked to aspects of the UDA in that area. And it seems to be that this man's been targeted by the UDA. The graffiti appeared, the police are linking that to it as well, making accusations. Also, there's no names on the graffiti. It's something I remember. It was brought back to me. I remember reporting on something very similar back in 2002, where a man was nailed to a fence in Seymour Hill in Dunmurry. But it's been a long time since I've heard of anything quite as barbaric as this.
The police will know who the UDA senior figures are in that community and elsewhere. Is it likely that this would have happened without being signed off from the leadership of the UDA?
So the UDA, unlike the UVF, operate as sort of, you know, autonomous type groups with local leaderships, in terms of they have had a lot of splits. There's been a lot of feuds and infighting, and the UDA who operate in that area would be not linked to the mainstream UDA. They operate solely by themselves. They would have been people who would have been fairly against a lot of the aspects of the peace process at the time. And that's quite a big unit of the UDA. So, yeah, it would have had to have been given approval by the leadership in that area, but not necessarily by the overall leadership. The UDA doesn't work like that. It's sort of like a, I don't know how I could describe this, like many fiefdoms almost, or, you know, with certain leaders and commanders and areas in charge of that areas, but they don't talk to each other in terms of getting approval or permission for what they're going to do. So, yeah, it would have had to have the approval of the UDA in that area.
I know we're going back over two decades ago, but you reported on something similar in the past, in the distant past.
I did. It's bizarre how you report on a story so long ago. I didn't even realise it was as long ago till I looked it up yesterday, but it was 2002. Yeah, a guy called Harry McCartan, who later spoke to the media about his injuries. He was assaulted. He had his legs broken and was quite badly beaten and was nailed to a fence with two 6-inch rusty nails were hammered through his hands. To a fence in Seymour Hill. Harry McCartan would have been at the time someone who would have been well known to police, and it was seen as a paramilitary style assault. He suffered quite serious injuries in that as well, and you know, it made headlines everywhere at the time because it was, you know, basically described as a crucifixion because that's what it was like. And this is very similar. You can see in the videos that were taken yesterday by a lot of the media over there, you can see where the fence is cut. So when someone has injuries like this, the emergency services at the scene don't try and take those nails out because you could cause extensive bleed. What they actually do is they cut the fence, and the fence with the nails still attached to it, and the person is then taken to hospital and they have to be operated on, and that has to be removed in very controlled circumstances. So you can see where the fence is cut, where he's been, and you can see his hands have been spread quite a distance. So it must have been shocking for anyone who witnessed the barbarity of that, because, I mean, even the site itself, I'm sure, will leave lasting scars, not just on the person who received the injuries, but the person who witnessed it. I know that there was a nurse then in one of the camper vans parked nearby who tried to give assistance at the scene.
Alison, thank you very much indeed. Thanks for your reporting this morning. The Alliance MLA, Sian Mulholland, is with us this morning. Good morning, Sian.
Morning, Stephen.
It's going to be the usual. It's going to be the police can't get information because people are terrified of getting burnt out or indeed getting nailed themselves. And so here we are paralysed in Northern Ireland with these gangsters able to get away with this.
You know, Stephen, this is really shocking. And just as Alison was talking there, I mean, I was a youth worker just after that event in Seymour Hill, and actually worked with the young girl who lived in the house opposite where the man was found, and the trauma that she felt even in later life. And this is trauma that's going to be felt throughout the village, throughout all of those tourists. And then you also have to think about our first responders who actually had to deal with that. He had to treat the man. You know, the ripple effects of this will be very widespread. And there's a sense of shock in Bushmills. Anybody that I've spoken to is just really shocked that this happened on their doorstep on a bank holiday weekend, and obviously being Northwest weekend as well. You know, it's a really busy, busy wee town. I was in it all day Friday, doing constituency visits and a constituency surgery as well. You know, and there was a real buzz about the town because it was such a nice, nice weekend. And it is shocking. My first action yesterday was to contact the area commanders to get an urgent meeting that will hopefully be scheduled at some point this week, just to talk through some of the concerns. There's the usual chatter, Stephen. And to be honest, I won't even entertain it. This was unjustifiable.
Oh, sorry. I'm not talking about concerns about the person who was attacked. I thought you were talking about concerns about the people that undertook this attack may do it again, or who are they?
Well, I think, you know, obviously the Irish News this morning is reporting that this is the third incident in the past year in Bushmills. You know, I think across our communities, there is a concern that about our policing levels, about the impact of community policing, and the impact of not having enough police on the streets. So that is something that I'll be raising with the PSNI, although it is an operational issue. I'll be having an honest conversation with the police this week. About are there themes, are there concerns that they have, are there barriers to their community policing within North Antrim, and then we'll be going from there.
Sian, thanks very much indeed. Thank you. Good morning to you. 9:15. We turn now to the heart of our whole system in Northern Ireland, the Northern Ireland Civil Service and our government. And the COVID inquiry is in Belfast, is here in Northern Ireland, trying to establish answers on behalf of all of those people who lost their lives, their families, the people who sacrificed so much, the doctors, the nurses, the Northern Ireland Health Service staff who risked their lives to try to save those of us who were in danger. The police, the community who sacrificed so much. These questions are so important, not just to understand what happened in the past, but to protect us all for the future. So what has been happening within our government? Well, the COVID inquiry is entitled to all of the documents and all of the conversations that happened within the civil service, within the government. They're not asking for a favour. It's the law that they are handed over. So here in Northern Ireland, through that COVID inquiry, apply the smell test to the following. The notes that were written after the Sinn Féin then Deputy First Minister Michelle O'Neill addressed the executive about why she had gone to the Bobby Storey funeral. The inquiry asked and asked and asked multiple times for those notes, and the Northern Ireland Civil Service told them they were lost. They weren't lost. It was untrue. The Northern Ireland Civil Service found out the COVID inquiry has now seen an email dated August of last year where the Northern Ireland Civil Service confirmed they had them. Did they give them to the inquiry? No, they did not. And it was only after the COVID inquiry spoke publicly a few days ago that the Northern Ireland Civil Service handed over those notes. So put that on pile number one. Then take pile number two. The Northern Ireland Civil Service were written to and were told, do not wipe phones. Do not wipe information, WhatsApp messages, text messages. Do not do it. You're legally required not to do it. What did your Northern Ireland Civil Service do? They wiped them anyway. So is that a mistake? Oh, we just so happened to wipe that vital information. Then let's take the interim head of the Northern Ireland Civil Service, a lady called Jane Piper. Jane Piper told the COVID inquiry that she had not wiped information from her phone. COVID inquiry have established that she did. She then told the COVID inquiry, Jane Piper, this is our interim head of the civil service at the time. She then told the COVID inquiry, look, I handed the equipment back in. Don't worry, it's handed back in. Guess what? The Northern Ireland Civil Service claim they happen to have lost that equipment. What the hell is going on? We expect the people at the very top of our systems in Northern Ireland, we expect our government system, we expect our civil service system to be robust, to protect every single one of us, to have the perception of integrity. Now, the Nolan Show is introducing an extra question this morning, which hasn't been contemplated so far. Let's take what I've told you just now. in terms of the Northern Ireland Civil Service claiming that Jenny Piper's equipment has been lost. What type of information would be on the equipment of the interim head of the civil service? Would there be issues of national security? Would there be confidential information regarding the police, regarding our justice system, regarding victims of sexual abuse, regarding other matters of life and death? So do we know if they've lost it or claim to have lost it? Do we know if that equipment is still in that building? How do we know it hasn't gone outside the building? How do we know our interim head of civil service, was it password protected? Can someone hack into it? Is life at risk? And so what we have done, so far not responded to, is we have written on your behalf to the Northern Ireland Civil Service. And we have said, with regards to the phone and or the laptop, which the COVID inquiry is now being told is, quote, lost, we've said, given Jenny Piper's senior role, how is it not possible that information pertaining to national security, victims of sexual abuse, police, politicians, other sensitive data has entered the public domain? Or if it's in Stormont, who has access to it? Like, is it lying in a bin somewhere? What the heck is going on at Stormont? We've asked them, has the Information Commissioner been informed? Or should any person associated with sensitive data now be informed about the possible security risks associated with Jenny Piper's equipment going missing? We've asked them, is there a risk to life if this information is or could be in the hands of dissidents? Because if they don't know where it is, how do they know it's in that building? And so far, the Northern Ireland Civil Service have failed to answer our questions, which we put in on Friday. And we've asked them, how can the public trust the civil service with sensitive information? And are emergency measures being now put in place by the current head of the civil service, Jane Brady? Well, she's undertook an investigation, she's told the COVID inquiry. Should that investigation be at arm's length from the civil service? Does it need to be someone looking from outside in? While that investigation's being undertaken, is our information secure? You think about the sense of information that a government would have. And finally, just what is and how is there a tendency for stuff to be lost, be it that it is wiped or be it that they can't find it? What the heck is going on? Now, you can talk about this today. 03030 80 55 55 is the number to call. Writing over the weekend, the Belfast Telegraph's Sam McBride said there is a rottenness in Stormont which has not been excised by the RHI inquiry or by the platitudes of ministers and senior civil servants, and now it can't be hidden any longer, he says. I've been speaking to him and asked him about it.
I think that when you look at this in the round, we're not talking about one individual, two individuals. We're not talking about one political party. We're talking about a system of government. That doesn't mean that everybody in that system of government is rotten. It doesn't mean that everything in that system is broken. But this is that fundamental. This is a system which even in the circumstances that we find ourselves in, where people were dying, where this was the most extreme circumstance you could possibly have, where you would think that people would pull together, they would do the right thing for the right reason, and afterwards they would be transparent about it. That's simply not what was happening here.
Let's go through some of the examples that we now know did happen that leads you and others to be thinking like this.
Well, if you take one example here, we were told at the time by Stormont ministers that they were working together. As the pandemic approached us, they said, we're united. There was that period where that looked to be the case outwardly. And what we see from this is that really right from the outset, that was not at all an accurate sense of what was going on behind the scenes. We had the most senior civil servant to the executive, David Stirling, repeatedly dismayed. This wasn't a man who looked at them after one difficult long meeting and said something that on reflection maybe he thought wasn't accurate. Time and time again, he was just dismayed by what he saw from these people, arguing, fighting at the executive table, briefing against each other, leaking against each other. And that went on and on and on. He says that was something which got better at various points when things were better. Then it got worse, we know. But that's really intrinsic. But then when you look on the civil service side, at the lack of any preparedness here, they were 18 months behind planning for a flu pandemic. We know that this wasn't a flu pandemic, but that's about as close as you could get to planning for what we had here. They were 18 months, a year and a half behind. So that's not something you can entirely blame on politicians. They have some role in that. But you had a system here that could not cope with planning for what governments are meant to expect. They're meant to expect war, pestilence, famine, whatever it might be, the worst possible things that they think never will happen, but they have some plan sitting there. Here they didn't. And the group of civil servants inside Stormont Castle who are meant to prepare for those things were meant to have 12 people. They had 2 people. I mean, think about that. 2 people planning for things that 12 people are meant to be planning for. Then once COVID came and they set up this crisis hub to try to manage the Stormont response to it, they put out a call for volunteers. Now, first of all, think about that. In an emergency, it doesn't seem to be in the contracts of civil servants that they have to go to this emergency hub. They have to be asked, would you like to go? Would you put your hand up, please? And when they did that, they got one volunteer. One volunteer. So it was 10 days into lockdown in March 2020 before that hub was fully staffed because they couldn't get volunteers. Now, think about the size of the civil service. It's got 23,000 members. I'm sure that not all those people were necessarily the people who had the skills for that hub, but that's an extraordinary number of people. Doctors were going out, nurses were going out, people were going to work in Tesco's, risking their lives as they saw it at that point. We didn't know how dangerous this thing was, and civil servants were having to be asked to volunteer, and they simply didn't volunteer.
I want to explore with you, Sam, the tendency for the civil service to be wiping documents when they were instructed not to wipe them, to be losing phones when they are trusted not to be losing key documents, and then abracadabra, when it's declared at the inquiry that the documents were not produced, guess what? They suddenly found them months and months later. So let's walk through this together. These were some of the handwritten notes that happened in the executive meeting. This is just but one example, and I want to go through a number of examples of the exchange between Michelle O'Neill and the rest of the executive after the Story funeral. The handwritten notes allegedly went missing.
So This is one of the most concerning elements, Stephen, because it's not simply about what happened 2, 3, 4 years ago or prior to that where they hadn't planned properly. This is really right up to date. It's under the watch of the current civil servants who are there in many cases. It's involving in some cases people who are still in very significant roles in the Stormont system. And when you look at this, first of all, the COVID inquiry went to the executive office in late 2022. And they asked them for all their records, basically. They got back the formal minutes of executive meetings. And when they saw those, they expressed surprise at how little they said. Basically, they said nothing. They said, we have decided to do this. Bam. We've decided to do that. Bam. No real record of what was discussed at those meetings. So they said, is there any more? And what they discovered, to cut a long story a little bit shorter, is that there was a record hidden behind the official minutes.
What do you mean hidden behind it? What do you mean?
So if anybody knew to ask for government minutes, they would ask for the record of a meeting. And the formal record of the meeting contained a very limited amount of information. But inside the Stormont system, they had another record that contained a much fuller version of what was said at that, a blow-by-blow account of these really ferocious ministerial rows. So if I give you one example of this, there's one set of Stormont executive meeting formal minutes, which are 4 pages long, okay? Don't really say very much. Large type bullet points, not very much text on those 4 pages. There's another Stormont executive meeting where there are almost 50 pages of handwritten notes of what actually happened, what actually was said, who said what, who shouted at who. All of that stuff is in this informal record, which is inside the Stormont system. So you've got two sets of records, one that they give when people ask for them, and another that they have to draw upon themselves if they want to use it. So having discovered that these second set of records existed, then the inquiry obviously asked for them. And it took them in total, I think, 10 requests before they got these released. Now, is that a system that is open and transparent today? Forget what happened back then. Is that open right now under Jane Brady, the head of the civil service? You have to ask 10 times. And think about the power that this inquiry has. It can basically put people in jail if they are found in contempt for not giving it it what it has asked for in a lawful sense. It's got incredibly powerful powers. And yet, even here, this is how they behave. Think how they behave to you or me. Think how they behave to a person in the street who goes and says, look, I've got a concern or I've got an interest in this. Please give it to me. Have you got a hope of finding out the true story from inside this system?
So when the inquiry was asking for the records, was there someone in Stormont knowing that they weren't handing over all of the information as they were required to do?
So what we find here is that there is a contradictory message being given by the executive office to this day. Last week, on the first day of the COVID inquiry sitting in Belfast, their counsel stood up and said, we've asked for these notes. We've asked again and again. They haven't been given. And you reported that. I reported that. Other journalists reported that. Then the following day, they got a letter from Stormont's lawyers basically saying, we're terribly surprised about all of this. We thought you had this. But when you go back and look at the timeline here, it's clear that Stormont Castle, the top, the most senior Stormont department that there is, where the First Minister sit, where the Deputy First Minister sit, they weren't there at the time, but they're there now. It knew last August, even if they didn't know in late 2022 that they had these informal minutes, these informal notes of that executive meeting, they definitely knew last August. They were aware of it. On the 3rd of August last year, They said internally, we found these notes, but they didn't give them to the inquiry. And so you have this period.
Why not?
Well, that's not clear, Stephen. That's something for other people, I think, pardon me, to be asking questions of the Stormont system, of our ministers now who are back, pardon me, It's something which our ministers ought to be taking a very significant interest in, because they have an interest in knowing that they're able to get this information, that this system is able to lay its hands on key documents, that they don't go missing, that there's document security, and that is not something that they're going to be blamed for at some future point. But what we are able to see from this timeline is that last August, they know they have them. They don't go to the inquiry. And the minute that this is made public, Stormont's lawyers write to the inquiry, and after expressing surprise they don't have them, etc., they say, here they are. We still haven't seen those notes. We don't know what's in them, but they will be published, and that will be very interesting.
On a separate matter, along the same theme of stuff going missing, not being able to be found, let's look at Jenny Piper. She was in a senior role at the end of the day. She was the interim head of the civil service. Now, why was she the interim head? Where had David Stirling gone to, Sam?
So David Stirling is moving into his final months as COVID hits. He then retires in August of 2020. and the DUP and Sinn Féin cannot agree on who will succeed him. So there's nobody. The civil service is left leaderless for about 3 months. And in early December, in comes this temporary head of the civil service, Jenny Piper, former civil servant. She's being brought out of retirement here, and she's there for 9 months.
So she comes in to post the interim head of the civil service. So she's not at the bottom of the information flow. She's at the very top. She is asked if she had wiped her phones. She tells the inquiry, no, she didn't wipe her phones. We now learn from the COVID inquiry that she did.
Well, this is a truly remarkable and frankly slightly bizarre situation, Stephen, because Jenny Piper gives this very clear message. I didn't wipe my phones. And secondly, I had two phones, a work phone and a personal phone, and I would never have used my personal phone for work business. So you've no need to think about that. What we now find out is that Jenny Piper used both of her phones for work business. She did delete messages off both of those devices. And we know that because it seems from the timeline given to us by the inquiry that Dr. Andrew McCormick, a very senior official who was involved in RHI, who was at this point at the very end of his career, but was the second most senior civil servant in Northern Ireland, just beneath Jenny Piper, he had been corresponding with her back and forth by text message, and he handed in to the inquiry messages which were coming from her. So he handed those over. And at that point, the inquiry said, hang on a minute, Ms. Piper, what have you been doing here? Why have you not given us this? You told us you didn't delete messages. And more than that, you told us you didn't even use this phone. So that's how we got the truth of this, if you like. And what those messages show is that there was a very senior official called Sue Gray. She's now the key advisor to Keir Starmer, the future prime minister, probably. And she was somebody who had just left Stormont in May of 2021 as a very senior civil servant in Stormont's finance department. She had left to go back to London, and some people in the Stormont system were very unhappy at her. And there were messages that Jenny Piper says were inappropriate from her, which she deleted in relation to Sue Gray. Now, there is a long element to this.
She told the inquiry she didn't delete messages off her phone.
Well, I think what this shows, Stephen, is that it's not a situation where we have people at the most junior level in the civil service who might be behaving like this. This is something where the person at the very top of the chain, you can't get any higher, you can't get any more experienced. She is doing this. Now, she says, look, this was all a very honest mistake. I forgot about this. I didn't realise, etc., etc. That may be true. I'm not in any place to say what actually happened here. But I think what we can say is that it's concerning that something like this happens, that a major public inquiry is misled, possibly inadvertently, if what she's saying is the right reflection of this, but nevertheless was misled about this. If it has been misled about this, has it either through people not realizing what happened or trying to put a gloss on things, being misled by other people in other circumstances? We can't know that. They can't know that. But you've got this system that is fundamentally broken.
This was the interim head of the civil service. This is on top of other phones being wiped when they shouldn't have been, other notes suddenly going missing. If we pursue the Jenny Piper story a little bit more. So not only did she tell the inquiry that phones had not been wiped when she had wiped information off them, she then also tells the inquiry, look, my work phone, my laptop, it's in safe storage in the Northern Ireland Civil Service. And now the Northern Ireland Civil Service can't find them.
Exactly, Stephen. So you've got a civil service which can't find the very sensitive work devices containing all sorts of data. We don't know what's on it. Clearly, she doesn't know what's on it because she says she wasn't aware of some of this stuff, which has been sitting somewhere in Stormont Castle, we're told, and they don't know where it is. So what sort of document security, what sort of data security does our Stormont system have? If that's how they treat their most senior person, how do they treat other people?
I think the story goes beyond that. And so I have written to the civil service on Friday, and we give them an 8 o'clock deadline for this morning, which they have not responded to. And I've among the questions I've asked Sam are the following. Given Jenny Piper's senior role at the time, how is it not possible that information pertaining to national security, victims of sexual abuse, police, politicians, and other sensitive data has entered the public domain with or without the knowledge of the Northern Ireland Civil Service? If they don't know, can't store, don't know where information and equipment is of the most senior civil servant in their building, how do they even know the equipment is still in the building? I've asked, has the Information Commissioner been informed, or should any person associated with sensitive data be informed about the possible security risks associated with Jenny Piper's equipment going missing? No response.
Well, those are all very significant questions. I mean, you do not have a more senior person in the Stormont system who's corresponding with London, with Dublin, with other national governments at various points about very sensitive matters. What this brings me back to, Stephen, is the RHI inquiry, where you had the sense then that you had Stormont spads, you had Stormont civil servants, you'd Stormont ministers going abroad to places like China, where there are very significant concerns about hacking, about government hacking, about trying to be very secure about how you operate, where they were going there and reading their messages off Hotmail accounts because they found it easier than using their work systems. I mean, it was a joke. It was an absolute joke. And they're negotiating for hundreds of millions of pounds with the Chinese. So that was meant to have been fixed. We were told all of that had been sorted. This has been dealt with. That's what Jane Brady, the head of the civil service, said. That's what Stormont Minister said. And here you find that whatever they did about that, they found other ways to be broken in a really alarming systemic way, which ought to concern not just us, but the people who are corresponding with them if they're not holding this information securely.
We heard Jane Brady finally, Sam, saying that she has asked, she was told the inquiry that she's asked for an investigation to take place. Should that be an investigation conducted by anyone within the system in Northern Ireland? Should there be an outside independent inquiry given the seriousness of this? Should the police be involved?
Well, certainly somebody from outside Northern Ireland should be involved. I mean, I think somebody in the British Cabinet Office would be very interested in what's happening here. They were deeply alarmed, I know, once they found what was happening during RHI. I think they'll be equally dismayed what they're listening to now. But if you look at some of what has happened right up to last year, where you've got the minutes of a meeting being altered, being changed 13 times so that they strip out any reference to wiping ministerial phones, even though that's the truth, even though we know that is definitely what happened. Some phones were wiped by ministers, by Sinn Féin ministers. Some were wiped by the civil service, mostly on the part of people who were from the DUP who were handing back their phones. But you had that very embarrassing fact. They knew it had happened. They knew they had to tell the inquiry. And you've got this message now from the civil service, Stephen, about how they're under the cosh. They have so few resources. They're under so much pressure. And I'm not for a minute denying that for some civil servants, that is absolutely the case. But when you look at this, this is a system that is able to prioritise people spending 13 times going back over a set of minutes to alter them in a way that actually obscures what actually happened with those phones. That's what this system does. I mean, there are massive, massive questions for Jane Brady. Whatever any investigation finds, Stormont committees ought to be asking her questions. She ought to be really pressed, I think, as to what she was saying last year about having fixed these problems. Last year saying they were on a journey of continuous improvement. I mean, you know, just complete nonsense. On Friday, she admitted they failed. That's the truth. That's good that now there is some admission of that. But there have to be consequences for that.
Okay.
RHI led to people being promoted. They were actually in some ways rewarded for what happened. That should not happen here.
Sam McBride, thank you very much indeed. Thank you, sir. This is so important. This is about every single one of you listening to this today. Your plumbers, your electricians, your hairdressers, your civil servants, your police officers, you come from all walks of life. And the system in Northern Ireland has a massive impact on you, your security, the confidence that citizens have in our political system in Northern Ireland, the confidence that we have that government is treating us with respect. Is there something rotten to the core of respect to us, the citizens of this country, to Jane Brady, the head of the civil servants this morning. When you say things are inexplicable, what does that mean? Have notes gone missing deliberately, Jane? Or does it just so happen that there are a whole series of coincidences where things are wiped when they shouldn't be wiped, when notes are missing when they shouldn't be missing? Why would someone, Jane, alter a document 13 times? Why would that happen? And when we asked the Northern Ireland Civil Service this morning, when we asked them on Friday on behalf of all of you this morning, if there are any security risks now that we learn Jenny Piper's equipment has gone missing, when they don't even provide the public of Northern Ireland with a response to that, I am going direct to you, Jane Brady, publicly this morning. This is it. And I'm asking you, Jane Brady, as the head of the civil service, is there any information on Jenny Piper's equipment that may put people at risk? And your officials haven't answered it, so we're asking you directly. What we want to do is play some of the audio from this inquiry to you. Jane Brady was questioned by counsel to the inquiry, Claire Dobbin KC, about ministerial phones being effectively cleansed by the civil service, despite being repeatedly warned by the inquiry not to do so.
If I may just generally set out the position in terms of some ministers, when the power sharing arrangements ended, returned their devices to their private offices, and private offices sent those devices to IT Assist, and they wiped the devices, correct?
Yes, it's fair to say that when the analysis was done, there wasn't a consistent approach in TEO post when I was in post. The devices were retained in the private office. Baroness Foster's device was returned prior to me taking up post, but in the other offices there was a differentiated approach taken.
All right, I'm just going to take it generally, if okay. I may. So for some ministers, they returned their devices to their offices sent them to be wiped. The question of whether or not they had WhatsApps on them or other informal mm-hmm. communications and may have deleted them beforehand is a different question, and a matter for them, but in terms of the process that happened within TEO, those devices were effectively cleansed or wiped within within IT Assist, which I think sits within the Department of Finance.
Actually, in TEO, the devices were retained in the private office. They were stored, with the exception of Baroness Foster's,
which
she stood
on. I understand. Okay.
So that they were retained, so we were able to take those for retention. In the case of the First Minister's phone, the PIN was not available, and the PINs we were given weren't able to be interrogated when we provided the search. And in the case of the Deputy First Minister's office, who in that case at that time was Michelle O'Neill, the devices had been reset prior to being returned, but they were retained. And they are still available in their current state. They haven't been reset by IT Assist.
Will you forgive me? I'm slipping into the mistake of and forgetting that you weren't responsible for every ministerial
yes.
phone. You're only responsible for those who fell within
yes.
the narrow
yes.
ambit of the Executive Office. So
that's correct.
The First Minister, the Deputy First Minister, the two First Ministers, Deputy First Minister and two junior ministers,
yes.
is that correct?
Yes.
Okay. And the question of what happened to other ministerial phones is a separate question,
yes.
effectively, because they were dealt with within their own departments and private offices.
And I understand other Rule 9 statements also.
Yes. All right. So just, but I think we do know, don't we, that
yes,
a number
we do.
Of those
yes.
phones were also variously either returned to IT Assist and wiped, or they were wiped or cleansed before they were handed in. Is that correct?
That's correct. And for the purposes of to assist the inquiry, given the issues that were raised, that was why I convened a cross-departmental group to have a view of the, of what had happened to each of those devices, so at least there was information consistency. And the report that I actioned, the internal audit report, covered all devices in the phone, for those phones.
Well, we won't go into every device and what happened. I think the important point may be how that happened, given the extent to which within TEO you had translated and provided the instructions that had come from Cabinet Office, and given the formal internal legal guidance that had been provided, and given the efforts that had been gone to ensure that different departments understood what their obligations were. I put that in a compound way. But I think that the overarching question remains how, despite all of that, did it happen that TEO or that the processes within government in Northern Ireland meant that when devices were returned, they were, a number of them were simply sent to your internal IT department and wiped?
Did I hear right within that clip that PIN numbers didn't work? It's interesting, isn't it? Did the civil service go back and say, look, these PIN numbers aren't working? Could we just clarify what the PIN number is, please? I want you to hear more from within this COVID inquiry. It is so important, this, to our democracy. It's so important to the victims of COVID. It's so important to their families. But this is about the next, 5-10 years of how the people that are working on our behalf in the civil service, about how our government works for us, this is at the core of the functionality of Northern Ireland. On Friday morning last, the inquiry heard about minutes that were sought from the Executive Office. Jim Brady said it was inexplicable why the full set of notes were not provided and why it took so long.
The inquiry heard this morning about the fact that there were specific minutes that had been sought from the Executive Office, and that repeated requests were made for them, and that those requests went unanswered, and that it wasn't until the fact that that minute hadn't been provided was opened at the start of the inquiry that the minute was provided. If that's looked at, for example, in relation to the fact that the wiping of the devices or the reset of the devices was excised from the minutes of the meeting on the 9th of May, that might give the impression that there is an issue, that if there is something difficult or something that's potentially embarrassing, that rather than being transparent about it or open, that steps are taken perhaps not to reveal in the hope that maybe the issue will go away. That's certainly the impression that might be given. Do you have any view on that, and whether there is a wider issue potentially within TEO around those sorts of issues?
I can see how the pattern of events compounds to draw those characteristics on that specific issue. For me, there are three particular areas of concern. First is when the disclosure happened. Why were not all items disclosed, not just the formal minutes, but actually the handwritten minutes as well, which is that first aspect, which is a concern about what was the understanding of the areas to be disclosed. The second piece, which is I guess inexplicable, is why was the full set of available notes not provided, and why were some lost as part of those areas? And then the third aspect is, when that was found and identified, why did it take so long for each of those steps, as you outlined this morning, for that to become aware? And when it was provided, why was it not correctly handled. And each of those are very significant issues and concerns for me. They're both inexplicable. I heard of those dates and correspondence today. I wasn't aware of the lack of disclosure of that item until you addressed that on Tuesday, and I heard again of those dates today. So the lateness of information coming even within the service, notwithstanding the lack of issues addressed, I've asked, following this correspondence, our head of DSO to undertake an investigation in terms of what has happened in that specific case. But I think overlaying of this, there will be many questions which will have to be asked about the late providing of information, the rationale why that was provided late, and how this builds into the overall perspective of what we're trying to achieve in fulfilling our objectives, our commitments and the code of ethics in terms of openness and transparency. And there are many areas of concern that have been raised through this process as well.
Jim Beattie, you talk there about, you know, investigating why information had been handed over late. Your organisation told the COVID inquiry that information was missing, that you knew, your organisation knew, was there from August of last year. Not you, but your organisation knew it was there from August of last year. On behalf of every family this morning relying on this COVID inquiry. Do you think they might be saying, how dare this Northern Ireland Civil Service not hand over the information that they knew they had since August last year? And many people this morning who are wondering whether when police liaise with government, when the government liaise with the Northern Ireland Civil Service, all of those meetings, there might be quite a few people this morning, Jane Brady, saying, how dare your organisation not put out a public statement telling us whether information on Jenny Piper's now lost equipment are matters of national security or matters that might affect the safety of people in this country? Where is the answer to that question? With regards to the Bobby Storey notes, the notes of the executive meeting when Michelle O'Neill was talking about the Bobby Storey funeral and her appearance at it, records after that first executive meeting in the early days of the pandemic submitted to the COVID inquiry on Friday of last week. Lawyers said 7 attempts had to be made to source the notes, which were thought to have been missing. Here's Claire Dobbin, KC.
Despite those notes having been found, and despite the sheer number of requests having been made, despite the fact that the TEO in fact told the inquiry that those notes weren't held, and despite the very specific questions that the inquiry asked about the precise circumstances in which notes like this could go missing, they weren't provided until after the opening had been given.
Like, how does that happen? What type of country are we living in? What is going on within the Northern Ireland Civil Service? Malachy in Belfast. Morning, Malachy.
How you doing, Stephen? Yeah, it absolutely baffles me how ordinary people, just as you say, the plumbers, the hairdressers, the joiners, listen to this bunkum, and no one is made accountable. And I years ago used to run a courier service, and we brought stuff all over the world for different people. One contract we had was with Ulster Bank, right? And here's what they've done in the private sector. If you had a sensitive stuff, they used to have all these bankers that done a lot of deals for mortgages and stuff and banking had, I think they were called BlackBerry phones at the time. And if there was a problem with the phone, that phone had to be sent to a secure company in Birmingham or Manchester, I think it was. I'm going back years ago to get the information, to get the phone fixed. And here's just a typical thing that they had to do. There was a company in Mollusk, and they had the contract to get these phones cleaned or wiped. Now, I had to provide a vehicle that drove from Mollusk.
I don't want to start to give
No, I'm not going to give names.
But I don't want to start giving details of how sensitive data is securely transferred by the Ulster Bank. I don't want to do that.
Okay. No. Well, this is just the sort of stuff that they put in to get this stuff done. We had to provide a vehicle. The driver had to be vetted. All his information had to be given in. The vehicle left Mollusc. The registration number of the vehicle, make and model. It had to be driven from there. The phones were put in a box that had a custom seal on it, which means no one was allowed to open it. It was very expensive to get this done. The vehicle then had to have a custom seal put upon it itself, which meant the doors or nothing could be opened. That vehicle had to go to the docks, and there had to be a tracker on the vehicle, and then had to go from the docks over to Scotland and then driven to England.
I get it, Malachy. I'm sorry we're just heading towards the news here. The question remains, why is the civil service being silent this morning about what material is on Jenny Piper's equipment, now lost? Good morning, everyone. Look, sometimes the Nolan Show takes an issue and we drill into the detail of it day after day after day. And we do that on your behalf essentially because that's what you pay the BBC for us to have the resources through your licence fee to make sure that it's not because of time, it's not because of manpower, that we can try to get to what is actually happening that affects your life. So is there something rotten within the Northern Ireland Civil Service? And I hesitate to ask that question. But when an inquiry is not being given the paperwork that is there, when phones are wiped that shouldn't be, when there's equipment going, quote, missing, is it unfair to ask that question? And then in terms of the respect in the relationship between the Northern Ireland Civil Service and all of you, have they lost any information that endangers people? Was there any information on the former head of the civil service, the interim head, Jenny Piper, that would endanger people? It's a fair question because she was the interim head of the civil service. Is there sensitive data about COVID victims? Is there sensitive data about policing matters? Is there sensitive data about security? Is there sensitive data about victims of sexual abuse? So when we asked this question on Friday in the public interest, we expected, and I presume at least you expect, an answer from the Northern Ireland Civil Service. They might tell us, look, the phone was the phone or the laptop belonging to Jenny Piper was password protected. They might tell us that to reassure us. They've told us nothing. They might tell us that there are all different levels of double verification before you can get into a government system. They've told you nothing. And in the absence of an answer to you, I'll repeat, this question is now at the door of Jane Brady. Ms. Brady, you're the head of the Northern Ireland Civil Service. Can you reassure people that the equipment still lost is even inside your building? How would you know if it's lost? And if it's outside, who might have it? Brendan Mulgrew, commentator, former special advisor. What's the smell test around all of this, Brendan? Do you think the public will have confidence?
I think, Stephen, that whatever the COVID inquiry finds and the questions that you've been posing on Friday and today, I think we need to separate those out because the COVID inquiry isn't going to look into the issues around missing laptops and security levels. So I do think that the civil service at a senior level would serve us all well by separating out the evidence that was given throughout last week and answers to those questions. I think that should be addressed separately. And Jane Brady said last week she was going to get an investigation into all of that. So let's see where that
goes. How can we trust an internal investigation?
Well, let's see where that goes, Stephen, and hopefully you will get answers and we all will get answers to some what do seem to be very basic questions. And unfortunately, when it comes to the way the some of those issues within the civil service have operated, it seems to be a rerun of too many elements of RHI. And, you know, we were all assured or reassured that lessons were learned out of RHI. And in fact, the report into RHI was accepted across the board by all of the civil servants, by all of the political parties, and there were to be actions taken and steps taken to implement all of the changes in terms of transparency and communications. And I think there are far too many questions still remaining. But it's important as well, Stephen, to examine, you know, last week was only the first week of the COVID inquiry. Later on this week, we're going to be hearing from a number of ministers who were ministers at the time and who are ministers still in our executive. And, you know, that was a time of huge pressure. We all knew that. And none of us thought that everything was absolutely A-OK and rosy within the garden politically. But some of the fractures and some of the lack of depth of the approach to handling the pandemic, to see it all laid so bare, and in the detail that we saw last week, like those handwritten notes, 122 pages of handwritten notes, which were taken in real time by civil servants as executive meetings were going on, the content of some of those is so shallow that it really is. I just imagine if I had a family member who died through COVID or was affected, and we were all affected to some extent, to listen to that excruciating detail is just so disappointing. And of course, the COVID inquiry will conclude that there are lessons to be learned in being pandemic ready and in responding better. But my goodness, there are also lessons to be learned around political leadership and the absolute need for our political representatives, most of whom are still there, to set aside, when it's appropriate, and it's always appropriate, to set aside constitutional politics and to get on with actually delivering for the people of Northern Ireland. So the detail which came out last week, and I suspect and fear there's much more to come in all of that. There have to be lessons learned around all of that.
You're absolutely right, Brendan, to distinguish the two areas, if you like, of public interest. One, the competency and the preparedness of our authorities ahead of COVID and what they did during it, with me very much underscoring that there were people working night and day, both within government, within the civil service, within the health service, everywhere in the public sector, to protect us. And of course, mistakes will be made. And of course, people will get frustrated. You know, the irony of all of this is you've got someone like Michael McBride in the headlines because of what he said. And that's in the headlines because he didn't wipe his phone and nobody else wiped his phone. And that the information was handed over. You've got all of that area of how the service performed and the lessons learned. But then you've got this other column. Like, you know, people aren't stupid. Do people really believe that instructions go into the civil service and they mysteriously on a repeated basis? The instruction not to wipe stuff and it's wiped anyway, on top of, oh, we can't find that anymore. Like, did they think the public are stupid?
No one is going to believe that, Stephen. And when minutes of a particular meeting, potentially the most contentious meeting of all, given the circumstances of the time, when they're the one set of minutes that can't be found, and then they do turn up, but they're not passed on, all of that just... People just don't accept that such a set of minutes can't be found. It's unrealistic. And but I'm not sure if it's the job or responsibility of the COVID inquiry to get to the bottom of those issues of how information was handled or not handed over. We do need a separate process to identify how that was allowed to happen, how those actions were facilitated or allowed to take place. I think that's separated out from, you're right, from the COVID inquiry and from the findings that the COVID inquiry are trying to get to. I think, as Sam said over the weekend, they were only here for 3 weeks. And in one of those weeks, there was a bank holiday. I think in the third week, there might be another bank holiday. So it's not even 15 days of hearings. So in many ways, the COVID inquiry, forensic as a questioning is, it's sort of scratching the surface in terms of the actual testimonial Q&As. Yeah. I know there's mass amounts of documentation are being published as well, and that will help us get to some answers. But, you know, Some of the testimony last week, Stephen, said that, you know, we were faced, the executive was faced with near impossible choices. I don't think leadership is impossible. And there was a really damning lack of political leadership at the beginning of the pandemic. That much is already clear.
You say the inquiry's only here for 3 weeks. As far as I know, the Nolan Show's here all year. The likes of Sam McBride and our colleagues in the BBC newsroom and elsewhere, we ain't going away. So there will be continued questions until we get them answered. Can I just ask one final question, Brendan? If we come back to Jenny Piper, the reason why I'm resting so much on that today was because she was the interim head of the civil service, and I'm trying to understand what type of information could be on the equipment of the interim head of the civil service. Now, as a former special advisor, can you help me with that?
When I was a special advisor, Stephen, the most sensitive type of information would have been a laptop that I would have been using or had access to would have been around executive meetings. I know, and the head of civil service would be many, many grades above that. But there'd be minutes of meetings, there'd be all sorts of departmental correspondence, which are copied into lots of senior civil servants. And of course, the interim head of civil service or any head of civil service is the permanent secretary to the executive office. So there would be all sorts of correspondence.
For example, confidential briefings given by the chief constable to the government, would the interim head of the civil service be copied into that?
I just don't know the answer, Stephen. I would imagine so, but I can't say that definitively yes or no. I'm not sure what way that system would work.
If there were high profile...
There are questions worth asking, that's for sure.
Well, they haven't answered it yet, but we'll keep going until they do. Brendan, thank you. Morning to you, sir. Joseph in Derry. Morning, Joseph.
Hi, good morning, Stephen. Stephen, on the subject of missing information, lost laptops, etc., and given the fact that this is such a high-profile piece of equipment, surely periodic backups were taken. And these backups would have been catalogued and stored.
I have no idea if that happens or not. I don't know.
Well, let's just look at what we and the general public are required to do. Whenever we declare that we're holding records in an automatic method, take the Inland Revenue, for instance, you're required to keep them records for X number of years.
I think it's 6 years, 5 or 6 years.
And if you take into account you're doing your accountancy in a computerized manner, you're required to take backups whenever you do updates, and you're required to keep monthly backups as the month end occurs. So therefore, in any given 12 months, you would have 12 backups.
Well, we don't know what the backup system is within the Northern Ireland Civil Service, but we'll certainly ask, Joseph. Again, there are two different aspects to this. You're saying, is the information restored so that all of that so-called lost equipment, the information on it, can be passed to the COVID inquiry? The other story that I'm pursuing today also, I'm asking the question, has there been a major information breach within the Northern Ireland Civil Service? If you think of the concern that was expressed when a laptop belonging to the PSNI went missing, when you think about the information breach that was associated with the PSNI, of how alarmed people were, how much information goes into central government, into the possession of an interim head of civil service, who, when she hands over the equipment, we're now told it's lost? Does the information commissioner need to get involved? Do the authorities need to get involved? And right at the very top of my questioning, do people need to be informed if their personal data has been lost? And the silence from the Northern Ireland Civil Service from Friday until now, could someone help me? Could Jane Brady tell me how that is either reassuring to the public, or what does this do for the reputation of the civil service? What is the answer? Let's see if we can get it. Thank you, Joseph. Morning to you. And our promise that we're across this story, we're going to continue to be across this story. We want to treat everybody fairly in this. Earlier on, we played a clip and we needed to include the answer to the clip, so we're going to play it again with the answer. So this is the head of the civil service, Jane Brady, being asked by the Cove Inquiry KC, Claire Dobbin, for her reaction that her advice to Stormont departments to retain information for the inquiry had not been adhered to. Here's Claire Dobbin.
Well, we won't go into every device and what happened. I think the important point may be how that happened, given the extent to which within TEO you had translated and provided the instructions that had come from Cabinet Office, and given the formal internal legal guidance that had been provided, and given the efforts that had been gone to ensure that different departments understood what their obligations were. I put that in a compound way, but I think that the overarching question remains how, despite all of that, did it happen that TEO or that the processes within government in Northern Ireland meant that when devices were returned, they were, a number of them were simply sent to your internal IT department and wiped.
Yeah, and for me, that is an area of I guess significant concern and issues, that there wasn't a consistency of approach, but also that the expectations that were set in the correspondence weren't delivered, notwithstanding the efforts that had been made. I think that there's, and the report analyses overall the kind of various different points that there were from that perspective. If you take the overall, the governance perspective sits with the Permanent Secretary through the information kind of owner and asset owner, and the obligation to inform then private office staff and the various checks and balances that were made. I think overall, from the awareness of the Rule 9 responses that came from departments, there seemed to be a gap between my understanding of official information and the understanding of official information and official records being the official record that is held in the system in terms of content manager. But my understanding, which I think is correct under the Inquiries Act, that official information is all information. Yes. And in the same sense as an FOI, is all information with the caveats of those which don't have to be disclosed for particular reasons. And I think that was a disconnect in terms of their perception of what met the requirements of disclosure, and that it wasn't correctly all official information. And I think that's been characteristic of the engagement that we've had, very regrettably, with the inquiry in terms of the fulsomeness of the information that has been provided, which to me was very clear in coming into post, was very clear in the information provided, but did not appear to be clear in terms of how that was given effect to within departments. And I guess if we look towards the report that was done, it analyses kind of policies in one context and another context. So if a device is returned to IT Assist, it should be reset. But should have been a decision made not to reset that, because yes, we were in a special environment. Had private offices been advised of the implications in terms of those areas? Had sufficient kind of assurances been got in terms of retention policies? What was given effect broadly across departments was that there was a hold on deletion in terms of content manager, which is the official record. But however, it is my understanding that rightly that the inquiry would want all official information in whatever channel that was provided.
Jane Brady, you talk in that clip about a gap in your understanding and the understanding of others who work below you. Is that about your authority then? A gap in your understanding and theirs? I'll remind you that this is about families distraught who have deep answers about whether they were treated properly by the government, about whether things can be deep questions about whether they were treated properly by the government, about if this happens again, how we will behave. A gap in your understanding. What does that mean? Does that mean that they didn't understand what you were telling them to do? Does that mean they listened to what you told them to do and just did their own thing anyway? And what about the gap, Jim Brady, in any of his understanding how sensitive data goes missing in Stormont and whether any of you can be trusted with it? Would that be a fair question from people worried about the information government and the Northern Ireland Civil Service now holds about them? We'll try to get the answers for tomorrow's show. Cliftonville have won the Irish Cup, beating Limfield by 3-1 after extra time. It's their first Irish Cup win since 1979. But people have been contacting this programme with images of some fans displaying flags with paramilitary and military emblems, namely the UVF, the Parachute Regiment, and an IRA D company flag. David Graham, former Limfield General Manager. Morning, David.
Morning, Stephen.
Good morning. And the Green Party councillor, Brian Smith, a Cliftonville fan. Congratulations, Brian.
Thank you, Stephen. As you probably know, my voice is a little bit sore this morning, so thank you.
It's all right. What do you make of these flags and military emblems then?
Stephen, there was 15,000 people went to the game on Saturday. I think the overwhelming majority of people behaved themselves in a very decent and correct manner. I think that there is no place for a lot of those flags, but I struggle here in terms of what can the clubs do if people want to head flags on them under their bodies and get inside the grounds. People were searched on the way in. That seemed to be okay. But if people want to smuggle flags in, they're going to find a way. I think the learning here for the clubs is, or not even the clubs, the IFA and the police, identify people. And if these flags are deemed to be breaking the law, then prosecute people fully to the full extent of the law.
Have you seen the photographs?
I've seen a couple of photographs. One of a D company flag, I think, and somebody with a UVF flag as well.
How do people get in with that type of stuff?
They wrap it around their body, Stephen. It's the same as smoke bombs. They'll stick the smoke bombs down their trousers, etc. Whatever. I think that some people with the clubs over the last couple of years, Linfield and Cliftonville have a very good working relationship. I know Linfield have had problems this year, there's been fines, etc. I have a large degree of sympathy for the clubs because it's more of a societal problem here, and for big games you're going to get a small minority of idiots, but for the overwhelming majority of people that went to that game on Saturday, it was a wonderful day, particularly for Cliftonville. But I've seen images on social media of families, of people, people that I know in the club for decades, and the joy that that's brought. But I do think if there's something there, I think the clubs need support from the authorities, particularly the IFA and the PSNI.
Well, David Graham, the police are telling us that they're aware of a number of images circulating on social media. They say inquiries are ongoing. I'm just intrigued even by that police statement. Were the police not at the match? They're aware of social media. Are they not observing the crowd?
Stephen, I think firstly, wholehearted congratulations to Cliftonville. I think they fully deserved their victory on the day, and well done to Jim Magilton and Cliftonville's a club, and that's very difficult for me to say as a lifelong Blue man, but well done. It was an unbelievable advertisement for Irish League football. The standard of football, the atmosphere was absolutely electric, and I think Brian will agree with me, and he left much happier than I did, but it was the best Irish League game I have ever experienced. And, it's a sad indictment on society. There's a lot of criticism of the Linfield board. One thing you can't criticise them for is their proactivity when it comes to trying to eradicate sectarianism and other aspects from the support. And I think that the Cliftonville have done exactly the same. One thing of note, Stephen, is that, on the day when you attract a crowd of that size, you will have what we term hangers-on who maybe don't attend a Linfield or Cliftonville game, any other game of the season. And I think when it comes down to, I saw emblems being displayed at the match and I've seen them on social media. You're right, Stephen, that is down to the police. That is down to the IFA to work to, A, identify these people, and try to eradicate it. But look, this, Stephen, is...
Well, the IFA say they're aware of a number of incidents, and they say, as per their normal procedure, the report of the independent match observer will be considered when received.
Yeah, but the fact of that will be that the match observer, if he has outlined that he's seen flags, if he's heard songs, that'll ultimately end with a fine for the clubs, but that doesn't solve the problem, because I think ultimately we are all in this together, where this isn't the Cliftonville problem, nor is it the Linfield problem. It's a societal problem. And, you know, from a sort of cursory glance at social media, those in display with the offensive flags seem to be very young. So that comes down to an education piece, and asking why people who were born after the Belfast Agreement signed 1998 feel the need to display emblems prescribed organisations.
I was up on the Boucher Road on the day of the match, and the families, the young people dressed up going to the match there with their mums and dads, the excitement. Like I thought to myself, this is Northern Ireland at its very best. Isn't it a pity that this is what we're also talking about rather than just the football and the family occasion and what sport can do for Northern Ireland?
Stephen, of course. And look, I took my two lads and we had a tremendous day out with friends, and they had their friends with them. And obviously the day was less tremendous come the final whistle. But I mean, in reality, as Brian has said, over 15,000 people in there, and you're talking about a 0.001% of those there that decided to display emblems. And it's sad that we have to talk about this, because we should be talking about the great work that Jared Lawler and Niffle have done to build up Irish League football, the great work that Kenny Bruce has done in terms of raising the bar and the standard of Irish League football with Lorn. The fact that, you know, you had journalists from right across the UK come to report on a historic day in terms of the first Irish Cup final between Linfield and Cliftonville since the 1930s. The fact that it was Cliftonville's first win since the 1970s. So there are so many great things to talk about here, and it's sad that we are focusing on that. But ultimately, it's something we need to shed a light on.
Just finally, Brian, there's something I haven't admitted to. So
what's that, Stephen?
Two of the fans came up and they said to me, "Can we get a selfie?" And I said, "No problem. Who's playing?" I didn't even know who was playing.
Oh, Stephen, come on.
I know.
You should know that.
I know.
The biggest show in the country, Stephen.
I know. Listen, thanks very much indeed. Thank you, Brian. Thank you, David. See you all tomorrow. Let's see if we get any answers from the Northern Ireland Civil Service ahead of tomorrow. See you then. Stephen Nolan.
Wie Führung in Zeiten der Unsicherheiten und der multiplen Krisen geht, darüber sprechen wir in unserem Führungspodcast. Ich bin Kai Dierke.
Und ich bin Anke Huben. Seit 25 Jahren sind wir Vorstandsberater. Wir beantworten die Führungsfragen unserer Zeit, inspirierend und informativ.
Wir räumen mit den Mythen der Führung auf. Und wir geben an aktuellen Beispielen aus Wirtschaft und Politik konkrete Lösungsansätze.
Dierke und Huben, der Führungspodcast. Jetzt reinhören und souverän an der Spitze agieren.